Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi folks, I'm Jack Kennedy and welcome to Farm Tech Talk, the livestock show. The sun continues to shine and grass growth is flying for the moment at least. Shout out to our supporters, the European Milk Forum and Grassland Agro for helping to make this happen. I'm going to talk to Declan Martin, who's standing in for Adam Woods, Aidan and Darren. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Sophie Bertrand from the European Milk Forum and Zoe Kavanagh from the National Dairy Council to talk all things dairy. We normally start with the quickfire buzz around, so let's go at it again. Remember, email your questions to farmtechtalk@farmersjournal.ie or WhatsApp 086-836-6465. Declan, looking at you first. The question is, and I'm going to read it out because it's a long one, ask Adam, which obviously you're standing in for, ask Adam, what are 500 kilo limousine bullocks worth now in the Marth, or what would they have to make next February to cover wintering costs if I sell them finished next February instead? Right, Declan, look into your crystal ball. Tell me what the limousine bullocks are worth at the moment and what beef price needs to be next February if they are to make a few quid. Talk to me.
Nice, easy start for me there, Jack. no, if you look, say, over the last few weeks, you know, the market has been a flying trade, 500 kilo limousine bullocks. You know, the average is making around the 220, 225 a kilo. Up to, you know, the top third are probably up there close to the 250 a kilo, even over it. So, like, assuming that they're your average kind of quality of bullock, you're going to be making 1150 up to 1200 euro on those animals there. Now, if you take them through to next February, look, you've probably the guts of another 200 euro to put into them, 250 maybe in some cases, to get them over the line. So my thinking would be a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, and I'd be cashing them in now there while the trade is good. There's huge demand out there in the market. I'd be cashing in.
Moving with them. Okay. This next question, there must be someone on a barbecue somewhere asking this. Is there really any breed difference in the taste of burgers? So the question is obviously related to mincemeat, and is the mincemeat of a Hereford any better or worse than that of any other breed? So is there really any breed difference in the taste of burgers?
It depends where you buy your burgers, but no, definitely there will be breed differences, but, you know, work by ICBF, and there'll be a lot more to come on this in the coming years, which show there's a huge variation even within breeds between different sires. And I know there's a lot of work going into that, that we can hopefully work on that in future and select sires that are going to deliver us a better eating quality meat. So yeah, look, there is differences. There's some of them that's marketed better than others, which are capitalizing on that maybe, but it's, as I say, the saying goes, there's probably as much difference between within breed as there is between breeds.
Okay, nice one. Declan, last one here. And again, it's a complicated one. You're getting all the easy questions. With 40 continental bullocks aged 25 to 28 months, okay, they're quite old, they're over 2 years, that haven't been fed at all yet, obviously they haven't gone on to meal feeding is what he means, I'd say. Does Adam reckon selling them now in the market or bring them to their birthdays, whatever birthday that is, and feed them on a bit more? Currently weighing 650 to 700 kilos. Declan, we've 40 big continental bullocks here. They're 650 to 700 kilos. They're over 2 years of age. They haven't got any feed, I'm saying concentrate, yet. Talk to me in terms of what might happen here.
Yeah, again, look, they're fairly rangy size cattle at this stage. To me, I would be kind of either pushing them on and getting them killed or, you know, selling them. You just need to watch your birthdays there as well. So some finishers, if you're selling those, would be put off by the older animals, you know, with retention periods and all that. So you just want to watch that one. But definitely at 650, 700 kilos, look, there's probably less pressure on carcass limits at the moment with a scarcity of beef, maybe. Mm. But still, you need to be careful and talk to processors and all that if you're going to bring those through to beef. So I would be saying, again, those 650, 700 kilo animals, you're probably going to get 1350, 1400, 1450, depending on the quality of them today in the mart. To me, again, it makes more sense to let them off.
Or else make your mind up, as you say, and try and get them away maybe before 13 months or something by putting in a feeding program. Like, yeah. Excellent, Declan. You performed well. We'll leave you alone for a minute. Darren, where will the price of hoggets go later in the year? There's another easy one for you. Ask Darren, where will the price of hoggets go later in the year?
That's a good one, Jack. But before I take that, the question you asked, Declan, you never specified whether it was just in beef. So if your man that's asking your question finds a butcher who's doing a lamb burger, he won't turn back to the beef at all after that. I suppose, looking at the price of hoggets, Jack, later in the year, it's hard to know, but early indications would show that they're going to be more expensive, that there's been a few lots of hoggets. There was a few in before this week, prices from 200 to 262. A couple of lots in Dower, there were sort of crossbred lots, 170 to 212, would have been lighter sheep. A couple of lots in Carnew, 180 up to 230. I'd say, Jack, that the prices for your tops of the hoggets is probably going to be somewhere in the region of 220 to 250, because after that point, it's harder to get sort of buyers to pay that for it, and it's going to be a small number. We won't have to wait too long. The Big Tullow Sheep Breeders Association sale is on the 4th of August. So, look, we'll be able to, okay, I suppose, maybe assess it in a week's time. But I'd say you're probably looking 20 to 25 up on average. But I think that there will be a bit of reluctance once you go over 200.
Okay. Last one for you, Darren, on the quick fire. And I think we touched off this again previously. Pour on or dipping not working long enough on my flock. Has Darren any thoughts?
Yeah, Ginny Jack, there's a lot on social media this week around that, and a lot of people talking about breakdowns, particularly, I suppose, maybe if the dipping or pouring has been to last 5 to 8 weeks, that lamb's done maybe 5 or 6 weeks. And look, a part of that is due to the intense heat as well and probably a bit of evaporation. And what I'd be saying is, look, for fellas, just to keep an eye on lambs at the moment, just in case there is a bit of breakdown in it. And if you are coming back in, I know we're past the sort of real peak temperatures, but look at over the weekend, there's still forecast to be 24, 26 degrees. I wouldn't be putting pour on during the day. Put it on in the evening, animals indoors preferably, and give it a bit of time to dry and stay away from the dipping for the moment until you can dip and or even dip late in the evening, the animals have a while for the chemicals to bind with the fleece and it's not evaporate.
Aidan, looking at you, a couple of quick fire questions that came in your side of the house. And let me get this right. I'm going to read it out because it's quite a little bit long. Aidan has wrote a couple of pieces on multi-species swards, but I've also heard at a discussion group that there is little or no advantage to growing multi-species swards for dairy cows. Where does Aidan stand on multi-species swards? Question mark.
First of all, I'm open-minded about it, but the research really is still only being carried out at the moment on multi-species. Look, I mean, there's two things, I suppose. Number one, a lot of the advantages of multi-species come from the clover, and you can get clover in the grass without putting in any multi-species. So that's the first point. Then there's the herbs, which are the chicory and the plantain. They then have other properties which are positive, but an issue with them is that early indications are they don't last very long in the sward. So you know, maximum 2-3 years is what a lot of farmers are finding when they put in multi-species. But then we've other farmers who have them in longer and they get non-fine with them. In terms of dairying, look, I mean, they definitely have a role in dairying. If they have a role anywhere, they have a role in dairying. So I wouldn't say that they don't have in that regard. If they have a role at all, that is.
Okay, yeah, that's fair enough.
So yeah. Open-minded, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. Look, we could spend a lot of time talking about it. We'll keep going and we'll touch on it again, no doubt. A second question for you on the quickfire, Aidan. Is too much clover a problem for bullocks on a paddock system? I had one bloat up on me. An old farmer said, this 75-year-old plus old farmer said, it could be too much clover. Is he talking nonsense? So is too much clover a problem in a paddock system for bullocks?
It can be a problem for all animals, Jack, you know, so the issue is the animals will gorge on the clover because that's what they like, you know, it's more digestible than grass. So they eat all that first. That then creates a kind of a fraught in the rumen, which prevents the gases from escaping. And next thing the animal bloats up. So that's the risk. I mean, the way to manage that, I suppose, is number one, you can put in bloat oil into the water, which mightn't be very practical on a bullock farm situation. The other option is to maybe strip graze them so that they're eating they can't gorge themselves then on the clover. They have to eat some bit of grass as well as eating some bit of the clover, and they get more fiber into the diet that way. So maybe put up a strip wire in those high clover paddocks is what I'd say. And look, animal performance should be better with the clover, so it's good. It's a good complaint, only just needs to be managed.
Excellent. Thanks, Aidan. That's all I have on the quickfire for you. Declan, coming back to you in terms of, I suppose, what you have in the paper. You have a nice piece here in terms of Roscommon. And I suppose, you know, he's a tri farmer in terms of he's doing dairy beef and he's trying to make the most of it. Give us a flavour for what's happening on that Roscommon farm and kind of what kind of benefits he's seeing to that system.
Yeah, Diarmuid Murray is farming with his father and his uncle there in Roscommon, just outside Knockrockery. So they're on fairly dry land. They're heavily stocked. They're milking 130 cows, and then they've an outblock of ground about 60, 65 acres. And they bring all their calves, then all the progeny through to beef because of that. And look, being realistic, if that ground was lying into the milking platform, he wouldn't be doing any dairy calf to beef. But they're trying to make best use of the resources they have. So that's why they're bringing everything through. 100% AI. So he has some Frisian bullocks, and then the rest are all mated to predominantly Angus over the last couple of years. So doing a good job. Again, winter accommodation would be limiting, so he's looking at getting everything away before the end of the second grazing season. So I visited him there last week, and the finishing cattle are actually housed for the last fortnight or so because grass growth has just been very poor. Like, you know, he'd have a demand there of maybe 45-50 kilos, where he's only been growing south of 30 there for the last while. So he was really, you know, he was trying to slow them down. He was feeding me like grass, trying to slow down the rotation, but just got to a stage where every week he went out to do his grass walk, his average farm cover was depleting. So the decision was made to house the finishing cattle.
And Declan, was the reason of the poor grass growth, was it we'll call it management related, in terms of was there just too much stock on it, too much pressure on, and the grass wasn't getting a chance? Like, you know, or is it kind of drought related, or what's impacting on grass?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of everything, Jack. It was a pinch point there. He had second cut silage closed up, which he's since made, and that's going to be coming back in, which will release the pressure a small bit. Heavily stocked, and then just have probably been gone a month or 5 weeks there with very little rain. They got rain there a fortnight ago, which was really heavy and probably didn't fully soak into the ground to do as much as it could as it could. They would be on light enough ground for the area, so just weren't getting the growth rates. Plenty of fertilizer out, he would say, that just wasn't getting the response from it. So,
okay. Sorry, I cut you off midstream. So, in terms of feeding and kind of getting those bullocks away before, you know, before the second winter, like we'll say, when's he starting, and kind of what kind of has he any weights in terms of where stock are now in terms of weights and where they need to be, kind of.
Yeah, so Angus heifers weighed last week were 420 kilos on average. So the most forward of those would probably be starting to be fed on 3.5 kilos of meal at grass now. So they are going back out to grass. I was talking to him again the last couple of days. He is deciding to put them back out to grass. The ones most far away from slaughter, he'd probably keep in the furthest on because, you know, they were settled on their diet. I said to him, look, I wouldn't bother putting them back out again, but obviously it's going to come as a greater cost, but when they're in and they're settled and they're performing, you know, you'd be reluctant to put them back out. But I was talking to him again since, so they are going back out with any of those that won't be finished in the next 3 weeks or a month. And he will start to meal feed them at grass, 3.5 kilos or so, and try and get them away. You know, he'll have everything killed by 19 months, kind of starts killing at six, heifers at 16 months. So you're talking light enough carcasses, but again, for the system that they're trying to run, it kind of has to be that way.
Yeah, so he's getting away with the cost without the cost of that second winter. Like, in terms of grass growth, around the country, Declan, is there more people in that kind of pinch in terms of grass growth, or has that rain that came? I know it's very warm now, obviously, and there's great sunshine, and the forecast is for something similar. Like, but I mean, is there guys that tight on grass in your side of the world?
Yeah, again, it depends on stocking rate, Jack, and land type. So guys that are heavily stocked on lighter land really are finding the pinch point. I was talking to a couple of farmers up in Louth and Meath, and they're really struggling, you know, supplementing cows at grass, that kind of stuff, and pulling in, say, autumn bulls and pushing them on earlier than expected. But, you know, on heavier ground, grass growth is still decent. And then, say, on the tri-farm down in Tipperary, it's trundling along kind of mid-30s there for the last 3 or 4 weeks. We haven't got any kick. You know, when that moisture came, it helped slightly, but we didn't get any massive kick in grass growth rate. But again, our stocking rate wouldn't be huge, so we're doing fine. So there is a pinch point there, again, where second cut silage is yet to come in on farms. That's been delayed again on these. You know, it's kind of compounded the problem because the yields aren't there to cut second cut silage. And they need that ground coming back in for grazing, but they also need it to bulk up a bit before they make it. So there's that pinch point there now. A lot of second cut silage, I'd say, to be made in the next week, 10 days, which will alleviate a lot of problems.
Okay, take the pressure off the stocking rate. Last one, Declan, in terms of I suppose reseeding, like is it happening on some of your farms, we'll say up the north, northwest, we'll say, is there much considering it? Like, I mean, you'd want to be kind of thinking of it sooner rather than later now, because I mean, you know, you get into September and the chances of getting a spray on afterwards, etc., anything like that are limited. Exactly. You know, what's happening?
Yeah, no, definitely there is. There's a lot of it starting to happen. So again, as I said, on heavier type farms, grass growth is fairly good. There's plenty of grass around, so guys can afford to take out a paddock that's not performing or take out a few acres. There's no issue there. So Kieran Milley has a good page in the paper this week on autumn reseeds, top tips for what to do and what not to do. Going, you know, I see a lot in the northwest, you know, kind of stopping the plowing and going with this mintail and stitching in. So you're getting back in that bit quicker. Again, for our type of ground, you're not, you know, you're much firmer underfoot when you try to go back in and graze that in the back end of the year. There is a bit more management with it, kind of making sure that you get your lime right, that you're breaking down that old tilt grass when you burn it off and that kind of stuff. But it seems to be becoming more popular in this neck of the woods anyway over the last few years.
Okay, nice one, Declan. That's probably what Adam is doing, improving his farmer's tan and doing a bit of reseeding up in Cavan. Declan, thanks for that. We'll have you on again, no doubt. Darren, looking at you in terms of, I suppose, the main things on the sheep side of things. Like, I mean, breeding, as you said, in the quick fire is coming sharply into focus very soon. And, you know, I mean, there's lots there for sheep farmers to be thinking about in terms of sheep breeding, we'll say. And you've got in the paper this week on it.
Yes, Jack, exactly. I suppose, look, there'll be a lot of people that will say, you need talking about sheep breeding, we're only after finishing talking about weaning lambs. But I suppose breeding really starts now, and it's, I suppose, picking out your cull ewes. Now is the time to do it, and you need, like, what a good year you have to pick out cull ewes. I know we're talking about hogget prices might be dearer for anyone that's replacing, but it shouldn't leave anybody in a worse-off position, and it's definitely a year where not to be keeping questionable ewes or poor performing ewes. Like, the big thing then, Jack, is to get them back working hard for you, but also keeping condition. And like, if we think back, maybe traditionally there was always a tendency to maybe wean ewes, leave them in a bare piece of ground for 3, 4, 5 weeks. I suppose it all built into this sort of thinking that let the flesh come off ewes now, we'll put it back on them in the run into breeding, and we'll get a kick from that. Like, that's really, I suppose, maybe a poor resource or a poor use of say grass resources that we have. Mm-hmm. And like, I suppose the ideal would be to be feed yours onto maintenance, use them to come in and graze after lambs. There is certain parts of the country that are very tight in grass at the moment, and them yours can be tightened up to do a job that way, and then prioritize your best grass for your lambs coming on. Pick out your yours that are falling behind target now, and put them in for preferential treatment. What you're looking at is to increase about one condition score will take about 8 to 10 weeks on good quality grass. For a lot of breeds, that'd be around maybe live weight of 80, 85 kilos. That's about 10 to 12 kilos. Some yaws will maybe gain that a bit quicker if you have a young yaw that's in start from a better base. But your yaws that really do need priority are maybe hoggets that are rare two lambs. They'll probably be lacking a bit of flesh. Yearlings definitely that have rare lambs. And then maybe yaws that are pushing on a bit as well and that you're going to do one last year for. And the one change, I suppose, this year, Jack, or the one thing we're talking about in this year's breeding supplement is, like we're talking about Eat a Ladder this week, and it's fresh in a lot of people's minds. That moves forward 10 days every year. Ramadan moves forward 10 days. Easter and Ramadan are going to fall within 2 weeks of each other again next spring. And it's trying to, I suppose, maybe preempt demand for them festivals. Look, at the end of the day, chasing markets comes with, I suppose, a bit of risk. You wouldn't be advising it, but it's worth people being cognizant of. Can they change their breeding dates by a couple of days, by a week, 10 days? Is there scope there to do that, to hit them targets? Like, people would have hit, I suppose, maybe Eat a Ladder this week. To hit it next year with the same amount of lambs, you might want to be breeding or lambing a week to 10 days earlier.
Good. Yeah, I know. I think I hear you. Like, I mean, you're right. Like, I mean, that's an important one. At least look at, flag it up there, make the decision with your eyes wide open and know that it's coming there. So I think, yeah, look at, there's lots to think about there, as you say, for those that are thinking of breeding, even with only a lot of lambs beginning to move off main season flocks now. I mean, Darren, did you move more lambs out of Tullamore Farm this week?
Yeah, Jack, we moved 50. So look, we'll have a nice bit of data. That's 107 lambs gone, 210 left. And really this year couldn't have been any better on Tullamore Farm. Like this time last year, I think I'll have to look back on the records, but we would be under 40 lambs moved. A combination of tight grass supplies, a bit of an underlying problem with coccidiosis. But it's the first year we've really got a right crack at it where grass supplies have been good. Like people talk about maybe weaning at 14 weeks of age being to be all and end all. Yes, if you're tight on grass supplies, but we'll probably end up Sean weaned on Wednesday. And I have to look back at the figures and lambs, but I'd say the lambs would be probably an average age of 15 and a half weeks. And we had the grass supply of grass. He held off from drafting for another, say, a week or 10 days above normal. And we got another 54 lambs away. And I think, look at this, everybody has to suit their own system. It's a bit like the breeding date as well. This is what works best for the system. And like we're in a good position now. The grass demand as goat is slowing back. We have a good cohort of lambs gone off, and we can put a plan in place for the rest of them now.
Yeah, and tidy up the O's as well if need be, as you say. Darren, last week you talked about maybe the kill being the highest kill of the year in terms of lambs so far. Like, was it in terms of the numbers? And what's this week looking like?
Yeah, Jack, hit 70, just shy of 78,000 head. So it was up 19,500 on the previous week. And that doesn't take into account there was a bumper kill Monday and Tuesday of this week. The previous Saturday, a lot of factories would have operated. So they did two Saturdays. There was two, I suppose, maybe there was a period of 8 to 10 days there where killing was really intense. And some of the factory procurement men said to me that on Thursday and Friday in particular last week, the biggest challenge that they had was getting enough freight containers to get lambs out. And like, that's a good sign, Jack, in that any time you got 80,000 out odd last week, if we were to add in the Saturday and the Friday the previous week and a Monday and Tuesday this week, I'd say that over that 10-day period, we could possibly be hitting 140,000 lambs out of the system. And like, one of the benefits of that is fellas drafted hard, drafted down on the weights. So there isn't going to be a big lag phase now. I suppose there isn't going to be a big sort of push on, or there hasn't been a big oversupply in the market. Yeah. Look at Kildare Chilling came in on Thursday and they set the benchmark with a quote of 630 base quote. It's leaving a lot of lambs, I suppose, maybe moving between that 630 and 640. We're only 10 or 15 cent back from the from the previous week. Yesterday's lambs being quartered at 6:20 to 6:30. But like we're really in a good position, Jack, comparing to where we've been in recent years.
I mean, that's very positive, that price piece that you mentioned there, Dan, given the supplies that are going out, given the lambs that were killed, like we'll say, like, I mean, I suppose there was an expectation that the price might even fall another little bit, but it hasn't, like, really, so is what you're saying. Like.
No, like if we look at where prices are at and looking at taking into account this, we sort of this time last year, we're heading into the ladder, but leaving all things being equal, we're about a euro a kilo above the price this time last year, like, and that's significant. It's 20 euros a kilo, 20 euros a lamb. We've seen, I suppose, the Chagas National Farm Survey figures this week. The sheep price, sheep farmers got a boost last year. Look, it's going to be better this year, barring there's a collapse altogether for the second half of the year, and that won't happen now, Jack. In there's a lot of sheep gone through the system. I think stall lamb producers are going to be out in force. We're seeing that already. And we're seeing good bite and good demand for lamb. That, like, it's really unknown, particularly in Britain, that the week after Eid al-Adha for prices to increase, because there's such, I suppose, maybe a high Muslim population over there that there's always a lull in demand. And like any week you get prices going up 5 pence a kilo over there spells positive. So look, it will be inevitable. There probably will be a bit more price pressure, but we're starting from such a good base that farmers can be positive about the weeks ahead.
Sell hard. Excellent. Darren, last one, in terms of grass supplies, I suppose, and what's happening out there in terms of some of your crew, you mentioned it earlier, is it a bit of a mixed bag in terms of, you know, growth rates, hot grasses on farms?
Yeah, hugely variable, Jack. And I suppose the one part of the country where we don't often maybe envisage being tight, or we often talk about Tipperary, Wexford, but like there's farmers in County Down and Armagh, particularly in some of the hill areas and light soils, that they're burning up big time. And I was talking to a few farmers up there this week that have tightened up yaws, brought in the creep feeders to lambs, segregated out, say, maybe your forward lambs to put on heavy meal, that their growth is non-existent. Whereas other farmers are starting to get it a bit like, I suppose, what Aidan said and Declan said, there's other farmers trundling along at 25, 30 kilos of grass, dry matter growth. They're keeping ahead of themselves. They will be tight if we don't get an improvement in growth. But like, there's no, I suppose, maybe real panic stations there yet. And then you go to the opposite end of the spectre, and there's a lot of sheep farmers on marginal ground, and the year couldn't be better for them.
Yeah. And Darren, last one, I promise, in terms of, you know, given lamb price where it is, surely it would pay those that are a little tightened up, we'll say, and that can do something to kind of push feed into maybe a select group or try and do something there, kind of to a proportion of the flock or something like that, that it must be worth a while doing that, like, you know what I mean, given the kind of, I suppose, they call it lamb price to meal price kind of ratio. Is that fair to say?
Definitely, Jack. Even where meal prices have gone, there still is a benefit from what I call strategic meal feed. And like, the one bit of advice I'd have to them farmers is sit down and divide your lambs into three groups. The first group is maybe forward lambs, 38 to 40 kilos plus. And I'd come in, say, maybe heavy enough with feeding on them. Look, if farmers will come in half a kilo, 0.8 of a kilo, will probably get the best response. But some people that will be pushed very tight of grass can come in nearly with ad lib there to ram lambs in particular, because you'll get the benefit of that. You'll get them out of the system and you'll get them going. The next bunch of lambs I thought to look at segregating is your sort of medium weight store lambs, somewhere between maybe 33 and 38 kilos, because you have some options with them. You have options of bringing in feed. You have options, I suppose, maybe of prioritizing grass growth for them for a few weeks. And then the last bunch is lambs lighter than that. They're lambs that I wouldn't be bringing in too much feed on, because look, they're a longer keep lamb. Some farmers, I suppose, Jack, what they've done in the past is some farmers take off the bottom core of store lambs, sell them at this time of the year, because what they're left with then is a lamb that will be finished, particularly if they're highly stocked farms. What's left, they'll be finished sort of by the end of September, start of October. They can build grass supplies. But I think that until you sit down or weigh your lambs and go through them, that's your first step in seeing where you are. Then see what the store trade is like, because in some cases, you'll get paid better for some of the lighter lambs at the moment that will do a better job of being gone out of the system if you're tight on grass now.
Good job, Darren. It depends on the scenario, as you say, on farm. Thanks for that. We'll chat again next week. Aidan, looking at you in terms of, I suppose, what's happening on the dairy side of things this week. You have a piece in there, and I suppose the whole piece around kind of greenhouse gases and methane in particular, in terms of what's happening in other parts of the world, and indeed some of the kind of, I suppose, projects that are beginning to start at this side of the world. And maybe just give us a quick flavour for guys that haven't seen the kind of, I suppose, the journal yet. Just give us a quick flavour for that piece you have there on the US and that project that they're talking about in Tipperary.
Yeah, Jack. So, I mean, when we talk about methane, it's generally in a negative sense, you know, about emissions to the atmosphere. But methane also has an opportunity, I suppose, for dairy farmers, because it's the output of slurries and all the rest. So in the US, there's a massive increase in the number of these biogas plants or biomethane plants. And they're associated with large herds in the West Coast, particularly in California, because they have Californian government, state government have introduced special incentives for renewable natural gas. And this methane that comes from the animal manures, when that's processed, they generate the gas. So you're seeing about 10% of all cows in the US now, their slurry or their manure is going to biomethane plants. And some analysts suggest that, you know, in time or given certain circumstances, the money they're going to get from the manure could be as much as the money they're getting from the milk. So it's a strange dynamic. It's one that we haven't experienced before. And I suppose, it's potentially a risk. Because before, if milk price was low or feed costs were high, farmers would reduce production, and that would usually level out the market in that case. But, you know, if a lot of their income is coming from outside of core milk, the levers that they have to increase or reduce production will no longer be as important. Mm-hmm. So it's a risk in that regard, and it's a new dynamic, I suppose, in the whole dairy markets.
And Aidan, it is fair to say, isn't it, that these plants want more than just kind of slurry, that they're looking for some kind of another feed source. Maybe it's grass, maybe it's silage, maybe it's something else. Like, isn't that fair to say? And that potentially could bring competition into the feed space for these cows.
Well, that's traditionally been the case, Jack, and that we've seen that all across Europe and all across and in England as well, and parts of the UK, and even Northern Ireland has that problem as well. That this, you know, increased demand for feed, so silage crops and maize crops, and the price of land goes up. But apparently, these bigger plants, they're more efficient, and they can cope with just manures. Now, okay. I'm not an expert on this, but that's what I've been told. And indeed, on that subject, there's a new plant, a proposal to build a new plant in Tipperary. And they say as well that all they need is manures. Now, okay. Not everyone agrees with that. Not everyone thinks it's possible. But this is what the promoters of the project are suggesting. And they're saying, because this is effectively a mega AD plant, much bigger than anything we have seen previously, and even way bigger than the ones you're going to see on farms in Germany and places like that. So it remains to be seen now whether or not they'll need other stocks, but they say that it should be able to operate with just slurries.
Your own. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay, we'll watch this space. I mean, as you say, it's a project proposal, and they're looking to sign up farmers and discuss it and kind of take it on at the moment. Aidan, in terms of bringing it back down to kind of basics in terms of what's happening out there, I know the Grassland Association had their summer tour, albeit virtually, says you, during the week. In terms of, I suppose there was two host farmers, John Joe Sullivan down in Ross Carberry down in West Cork, and Kevin Morn in Galway up the west. Give us a flavour for kind of what happened, and maybe some of the kind of messages that were why the focus on both of those farmers.
Yeah, Jack, all to do with clover. So they looked at it from two ways. So Kevin Morn is trying to establish clover on his farm. He's been making an effort, I suppose, for the last 12 months or so. John Joe Sullivan then down in Ross Carberry has been at clover an awful long time. So he started farming in the late 70s, and there was a lot of clover in the farm at that point. And basically, he's been trying to maintain that and increase it ever since. So he would consider about 30% of his farm now to be ideal for clover. So that's 25-30%. The amount of clover you need really to make an impact in terms of nitrogen. And then he has clover on the other fields, but not to the same extent. So he's working on them then constantly to increase it. And for Kevin Moore then in Galway, so he's only really starting the clover journey in many ways. And the big lesson from Kevin, I suppose, he did, I think 30% of the farm in one go last July, disaster. He'll never do that again. He'll always go in, start in April, do a couple of, you know, 5-10% of the farm at any one time, and then mind that carefully for the next 6 or 8 weeks. And maybe if time then, if conditions are good in May, he can go again. But he definitely, April or May are the months he's going to do it, and he won't do any more oversowing in later in the year, because it's just too, it's hit and miss anyway, Jack, but it's even more hit and miss when you go later in the year.
Okay, so and the problem being, Aidan, that you're kind of extending rotation, like even now, like here we are, the late July, we'll say rotation is extending into August, September, and hence you're not being able to keep on top of the clover. Is that or the grass in the new sward? Yeah,
that's largely it. Plus, I mean, if you think of it, like April, May, they're ideal times for seeds to germinate. That's the time of year that seeds germinate. Whereas it's harder to do that at this time of year, even if conditions, you'd say are right, and conditions are awful, you'd say, at the moment, because ground is way too hard and too dry. So that was the key message. But I mean, seeding, Jack, is the best way to get clover in. That was, both farmers are very clear on that. And then you need to reduce your fertilizer use where clover is good. So the O'Sullivans, they're only spreading 150 kilos of N per hectare across the whole farm. Now all their farmers is available to the cows. It's the heifers and all are there, which probably makes things a little bit easier. And it's not overly stocked either. I think they're stocked around 2.3, whereas Kevin Moran is a higher stocked farm. He's grown 16 tons. He's probably in a different position in terms of, he needs the farm to drive on as hard as he can, because he's relatively highly stocked. He's young and he's got a lot. A lot of land is rented, and he's got different requirements. But it's interesting, different, both on the same page very much in terms of how they're going to get clover established, how they're going to manage clover. And but really, Jack, I mean, I went away from it on Wednesday, and I was saying to myself, there's so many questions we don't yet know on clover. Yeah. And why are we accepting so many things about it as well? Like, can we not get, why do we just presume that, clovers won't grow in spring? Can we not start a breeding program that's going to breed clovers that are going to be there all year round, and really add more to us in terms of producing nitrogen?
Okay, Aidan, I'll leave you on this one. In terms of reseeding now, as you say, it's particularly warm at the moment. The sun is out and the forecast isn't for a whole lot of rain. Like, I mean, I see a little bit of reseeding going on. Like, is it safe to do it even when we have, I suppose, the warm weather without any moisture? Like, we'll say, I mean, would you still rock on if you have it in the pen?
I'd still rock on. I mean, it may as well be in, the soil is in the bag. Now, it's not going to grow, it's not going to germinate, but like, it may as well be in, conditions are good, rather than waiting and delaying. And next thing, it'll start raining, and who knows when it'll stop. So, you're better off to have it in. It won't do any harm to the seeds. Like, if they're in the soil, they probably won't germinate, but the weeds won't germinate either. So, until rain comes, it's fine. So, I'd sow away now.
Excellent. Thanks, Aidan. I'll leave you go at that. Earlier, I had a chat with Sophie Bertrand, who was the European Milk Forum, and Zoe Kavanagh, who's the Chief Executive of the National Dairy Council, and we talk more things dairy. Let's have a listen. Sophie, if I come to you first, just in terms of, I suppose, the European Milk Forum and what it does, maybe just give us a feel for kind of the work it undertakes, and we come on then into some of the campaigns that you're on.
Yeah, good morning, first. Yes, in fact, the European Milk Forum is an association between the dairy organization of 8 member states in order to develop common communication project with a European dimension to encourage consumption of European dairy products. So that's the main goal. And so in the context of the farm to fork strategy, that is not really favorable to animal products, we would say, we decided to launch a 3-year project that is funded by the EU to communicate on the role of dairy in a healthy diet from a sustainable food system. The goal is to raise awareness on the important role of dairy in Europe. And so far, 5 countries are involved. And the main idea, in fact, is that within the dairy sector, we are all aware that the dairy is key for the transition to a sustainable food system. But that is not the case for opinion leaders like media or NGOs. So we want to demonstrate to them the positive role of dairy, the efforts that are made on the ground, the progress that have been made already, to really raise awareness amongst consumers about the value of the dairy products in Europe. So that's our main goal.
Okay. And Sophie, I mean, we're obviously here in our bubble in Ireland, and we hear, as you say, a lot of anti, livestock type material, a lot of anti-livestock messages, a lot of anti-dairy and a lot of anti-meat protein messages, So I mean, is it the same, you know, across Europe and in other parts of the world, Sophie, in terms of that messaging? And you know, I mean, just give us a flavor in terms of some of the stuff that's going on.
Yeah, it's true that we can feel more or less the same in the five countries involved in the program, but with more or less pressure in the different countries. Like I would say in France, we feel less anti-dairy pressure, I would say. And I think it's linked also to the history of the culture of in France, where food is very important for French people. They really like their food and especially their cheese. So the discussion is not on the same level than the other countries, yeah. I would say.
I hear you. Yeah. Zoe, to bring you in there, I mean, milk is very important in an Irish context. Like, I mean, milk is synonymous as you with the breakfast, with other meals throughout the day and with young people growing up. But yet it gets a kind of a feral hammering at times in terms of, you know, the media message that's going out, the narrative that's there at the moment. Isn't it fair to say?
With this project, what's really interesting is to compare the five markets. So as you said there, Jack, you know, dairy is under pressure to almost defend itself, which is bizarre, given that it's such a part of the shopper's basket. Mm. And I think Sophie just pointed towards a really interesting point in France around culture. And I think when we look at dairy, not just at a European level, but at an Irish level, there's a rational element in judging dairy and there's an emotional element. Fortunately, on the emotional side, dairy products score really well. There's just a connection to consuming them throughout the week across the meal occasions. On the rational side, the nutritional benefit is understood and how it's produced rationally is under pressure because there's a lot of noise in media directly linking dairy to, you know, the climate change movement and the climate change concern. So what I'm seeing in this project working across the five countries is that pressure that you and Sophie just talked about, that rational pressure. If you had a dial of 0 to 10, it is a different dial set across the markets. In France, you know, it's more like at a 3 and a 4. Mm. And in Ireland, it feels like a 7 or an 8. Mm. And I think, and this might seem a little fluffy for a tech talk, what you know, your listeners need to understand is there's a rational side and there's an emotional side. And part of the work we're doing at a European level and domestically here at a National Dairy Council level is to ensure the connection between the consumer and the producer is reestablished, because we feel that's been broken. And I think when you look at a country like France, the connection between the consumer and the producer is much stronger. Yeah. And what I really like about working at a European level is identifying where the opportunities are for us. And I think in France, I look at it as a model market for a connection between the regard for food and the regard of how it's produced. And that's a key part of something we want to address.
Okay, Sophie, give us a feel for the current campaign that the European Milk Forum is running in terms of dairy in a healthy and sustainable European food system. Just give us a feel for kind of the pillars of that campaign.
Yeah, and in fact, in this campaign, we sort of recognize the efforts that are made on the ground, and we organize farm visits and symposium, and we also send many tweets on social media to really highlight the efforts and progress made locally, but also to highlight European data that are good for all of us, like to remember people that in Europe, the dairy is the second biggest agriculture sector that employed 2 million people in Europe in rural areas. So that is very important for the EU. We can also remind people that grassland covers 40% of the agriculture area in Europe, and that grasslands are key for biodiversity. So that kind of European data that are available for all of us, and also all the local initiatives that are made on the ground.
Okay, so as you say, and coming back to what Zoe just said, you are reconnecting people with your farm visits, those urban consumers, those people that are moving towards the cities and they're one step removed from their farms that the previous generations came from. You're really trying to build that bridge between understanding where the food comes from and the actual farms, like, yeah?
That's right. The main goal is to explain what's the reality of the farm, because citizens, media, NGOs, they are not aware of what's really going on the farm. So It's important to explain to them the constraints, the reality, the efforts made, the different levels of action that are made on the ground. And that's really important for them to recognize that.
I mean, Sophie, it's fair to say that not every country produces milk the same way. You know, I mean, here in Ireland, we're predominantly grass-based because we're lucky we get the rain and the sunshine like we're getting now at the moment. But we get a lot more rain. We're able to grow grass. A lot of your other European countries can't do that, but they grow other forages, etc. Isn't that, you know, I mean, is there, how do you kind of strike the balance between, you know, promoting or promoting that product, i.e. dairy or milk? You know, how do you strike the balance?
That's a good point. Yeah, that's right. In fact, we identify one big similarity between the different countries. The main similarity that in each country, the dairy actors already committed to a process of continuous improvement with transparent engagement assessed by performance indicators. So really, on the ground, the levels of action have been identified. They are already monitored and they are implemented by the farmers and assessed by independent audits. So that's the same process in each country. Okay. But having said that, the real practices on the farm are different. The tools used are different because they are adjusted to the regional context and also the farm context. And so there is not one solution fit all. Each farmer needs to adjust his level of action and plan.
So that makes your job so easy. You know, the fact that we are here in Ireland and we're producing milk from grass, like, I mean, really, you know, you must be a top performer in the top five, in those five countries that are actively participating in the European Milk Forum.
Go ahead. I think Sophie very, very diplomatically said, you know, it's all about signaling progress. Whatever your system is, it's about signaling the system is going to get better. Obviously, we are very proud of a grass-based system, and it certainly feels like a very positive system to discuss in the context of climate change. I think a really interesting point is about communicating a purposeful, progressive dairy sector, both at a European level and also here in Ireland, because the research showed us, and I think this is a watch out, that across the countries, consumers had a different view as to who was responsible for bringing about change. And what we're seeing is we've been tracking this for 4 years. And I think what's a little bit of a concern is people are assuming regulation, policy, and action groups, i.e. NGOs, will be the ones that will bring about change. Whereas actually, where I feel the dairy sector needs to get to is communicating that it's a progressive sector, that it's almost self-regulating and bringing about change. Because if we rely on policy and rules and regulation, which is influenced by action groups, we may find ourselves inheriting a set of rules and regulations that doesn't reflect the differences in the systems, across Europe. Mm. I think a really important point is, I think this project is helping us get much more proactive about communicating the progress that's being made. Because if people aren't hearing that, and if they're not trusting that we're on a path of progress, regulation will be handed down. And that regulation, back to Sophie's point, will have been framed in a European context that can't really account for all the different systems. So I think that's a key watch out within this program.
Yeah. I mean, Sophie, I mean, if would it be fair to ask you kind of in terms of some of the European-wide research, the consumer attitude piece in terms of to dairy sustainability and, you know, what exactly kind of consumers are saying, I suppose, about dairy sustainability?
Yeah, it's also interesting to see that the focus of consumer is not the same in each country. For example, the first concern for all countries is, of course, climate. That's the main focus for all consumers. That's true. But the second focus is not the same for different countries. For example, in France, consumers think that biodiversity and landscape is the second biggest focus of interest. But in Northern Ireland and Denmark, it's more circular economy that is very important for them. And in Belgium, it's more energy consumption, like renewable energy. So really the interest and focus is not exactly the same between the countries. And we can also see differences of how the consumers see the dairy sector within their country. We can see that in Denmark and Ireland, consumers see the dairy sector as more pollutive as in France and Belgium or Northern Ireland, where they see the dairy sector are more social responsible than in Ireland and Denmark. And also the fact that in Ireland, consumers are aware that the dairy sector is very important for the economy, which is not the case in France. So we have to demonstrate in France that the dairy sector is important for the economy. So we have to adjust our communication depending on the consumer focus.
Okay, so like as you say, I mean, Ireland and Denmark, two very, I call them commercial countries in terms of commercial dairy farming. I mean, they have to work on their social acceptability of that enterprise in the broader context, like within farming and within the consumers. I mean, it's very interesting to hear that. I mean, but Sophie, does that mean then that what Zoe and what the Irish team do will be different to what happens in France, you know, in terms of maybe that innovation or in terms of that project that they take on to try and bridge this gap and bridge this communication piece? There will be different pieces happening on of the five or eight members that are part of the European Milk Forum.
Yes, as I said, it's a European project. So we have a common program that is more the concept, the process that is the same. So we have the same action, farm visits, symposium, tweets, but then the content is really tailored to the regional context and is adjusted to the actuality of each region, to each innovation that is interesting to highlight. So it's really flexible and adjusted each year or even during the year to really adjust the messages to what the consumer needs to know.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of the Irish piece of work that's ongoing, we'll say, and your campaign in terms of trying to kind of communicate that challenge that Sophie presented there in terms of what the consumer thinks. I mean, what kind of, I suppose, are the fundamentals of the Irish campaign as you see it at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, we have two primary objectives. One actually is almost reconnecting the Irish consumer with a contemporary Irish dairy farmer. And I think that work is really important because we can see, in fact, we just conducted some research recently and 60% of consumers don't know a dairy farmer, have no connection to a dairy farmer. So that's a lot of people who have no connection. And I think first and foremost, we need to ensure that the farmer voice within our communication is presented regularly and that people have a view both visually and intellectually as to what the dairy farmer looks like, sounds like, and what a working day is like in the life of an Irish dairy farmer. That's first and foremost. And then a key focus for us is our natural resources. You heard Sophie talk about 40% of the land in Europe, you know, being grassland. You know, in Ireland, we know that that's significantly higher. That's north of 60%. So we need to re-engage in a discussion around what is Irish dairy farming, talk about the grass-based system, talk about the rainfall. And then we're quite interested in connecting, the consumers, the public at large, with innovation and technology and what's happening on farm today that, quite frankly, they'd have no idea. It wasn't happening 20 years ago. And that's, you know, we know the amount of data farmers are now getting to their mobile phone, be it, you know, grass growth, be it the composition of the milk straight back from the co-op, be it the soil pH. There's so much information there. And I'm only just talking about the natural resources. I haven't even got to the animal yet, which again, you know, a lot of information around animal health and welfare. So it's that classic, if you're not measuring it, you can't manage it. And I think the Irish public will be so pleasantly surprised to hear how sophisticated Irish dairy farming has come and what data is being looked at to bring about improvement in the context of climate change, in the context of animal welfare, and in the context of producing a really, really high quality product. And that's the purpose of our domestic campaign, as well as then reinforcing it at a European level with this campaign.
Yeah, I think you're right, Sophie, because or Zoe, because a lot of the messages kind of get lost in that anti-livestock narrative. The messages around what's happening at farm level get lost, you know, because you know, because of that domineering anti-livestock message. So that dynamic nature of farming and the fact that they are taking on new methods. Sophie, that happens, I'm sure, in every country, you know, in every, it's not just Ireland Inc. where the farmers are changing and becoming more environmentally friendly and becoming more kind of efficient. That's a European piece.
That's right. Yes. In every country, there are many research and innovations already in the pipeline that are very interesting to highlight to consumers because they are not aware. And these innovations are different in the different countries. So that's also interesting to have a European overview of what's happening. For example, to be very precise, in Denmark, they are very innovative in circular economy. So they managed to build a dairy plant with a biogas that is produced on the dairy farms around the dairy plant, and the biogas is directed to the dairy plant for the process, and the excess heat is also redirected to the houses around. So it's very, very innovative circular energy economy in Denmark that they want to show and demonstrate. In Northern Ireland, it's another focus more on nutrition, precision feeding, nutrition feed, where they try to really optimize the feed of the dairy cows to lose less greenhouse gas emission. That is also very innovative. In Belgium, they also improve a lot the feed. They try to reduce the soy meal they replace it by beetroot and rapeseed meal to reduce, again, the greenhouse gas emissions. So very, very innovative, again, in feed. And in France, we tried, the manure management is very important for the carbon footprint of the dairy farm. So we really try to produce more innovative management of the liquid manure storage, where you can cover the storage to capture the gas and try to build a light biogas production. We call it NENEFAR. It's like a new innovative material that is very interesting also for the farmers to reduce their footprint. So you can see very interesting innovations in different countries that we need to highlight and to show.
Right, folks, that's it for another week of Farm Tech Talk, the Livestock Show. Thank you for listening. Thanks to all our guests once again, and thanks to Declan for stepping in for Adam, a much more balanced approach, I think, to life. If you want more from Farmers Journal webinars, go to ifj.ie/webinar, or you can listen to the show as a podcast wherever you get your podcast. We'll be back again next week. Until then, stay safe and safe farming.